Hi, this is Tim Larson from Snowdrift Cider Company out of Wenatchee, Washington, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 37. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am your Cider MC on this weekly podcast where we chat with cider makers and enthusiasts from around the world. And this week, we're chatting with Tim Larson. Tim was busily pouring his Snowdrift ciders at Pour the Core, and we were able to squirrel away during the two-part session to have a bit of a chat. A lot of great cider making info from this award-winning cider maker. There'll be more on that chat in a moment. Before we head to the Pacific Northwest, we're going to head down to Los Angeles, California. And I heard from Peter Clausen, who wrote me a really nice email. I can't read it all, but right online now, but I want to give you a snapshot of what he sent to me. Peter works for a distributor, Half Pint Ciders, which he described as 100% cider-only distributor in the U.S. And what he wrote here was pretty cool, because he said that in 2018, there will be three or four cider bars in Los Angeles. They already have one opening next month in Long Beach, so next month would be July, this coming July, and 101 Cider is planning on opening one around downtown LA this year. And the one thing that I really noted in here that I thought was a really good overview, he says that we see a definite SoCal cider style. In large part, he writes, I think this is because we lack the traditional and cultural context of other cities, and we have no orchards of our own, so we have to rely a lot more heavily on technique and process than other cities would. I'm not sure what that is, but we're going to get to it. And since it's super hot here, people tend to like the more thirst-quenching, high-acid ciders with less sugar. Anecdotally speaking, when I'm out doing sales, I see the look of relief when I tell people the cider I'm pouring for them isn't a sugar bomb. Nobody claims to like sweeter ciders, and if they do admit to it, it's almost always with a twinge of guilt, which is sort of amusing. Well, I'm glad to hear that, Peter, because I meet lots of people who say they like sweet ciders with no guilt at all. I don't know what that's about. Maybe it's where I hang out in Ciderville. He had also an interesting hit on this. He says, sour beers are huge in LA, and tons of breweries make them, and more sour-only breweries are opening. So that's like that goose style, you know, really deep sour beers. They have become super popular. I totally agree. Not only in LA, but across the board. With that in mind, he writes, it makes sense that the LA cider crowd drinks a lot of sour ciders. That is fantastic info about Los Angeles. And being a media capital that it is, I think that there should be a movie about Ciderville, don't you? Wouldn't that be fun, going out and getting that on the airways and byways and highways and letting people know the diversity? If you want to do a little movie with Ciderville, let's do it, folks. I'm in. It's all about helping cider go up. Peter, thank you so much for sending me so much info. I will be in touch, and we're going to be talking more about the LA cider scene. And if you are like Peter and you have some good cider news out there, and we know it's all good news, please drop me a line, Rhea, that's R-I-A, at ciderchat.com. I do love California. But for now, we're going to head up to the Pacific Northwest and get on with this chat with Tim Larson of Snowdrift Cider in Wenatchee, Washington. And if you don't know where that is, well, you're going to find out in this chat. This was pre-recorded. in June at Pour the Core in Brooklyn, New York. And it's a bit noisy in the background, so we were in the middle of this giant cavernous building, beautiful expo center where they held this event. And so you're going to hear a little bit of that ringy-dingy in the background. But it's all good, and it was such a pleasure to chat with Tim, who gave some really nice insight both to his ciders and Perry's and to cider making components that we haven't really talked about in this chat. So without further ado, let's all grab a glass and join this chat with Tim Larson of Snowdrift Cider in the great state of Washington.
Most people, when they think of Washington, think of Seattle, and they think of rain. But really, Washington is probably one of the most diverse states in the U.S. We've got rainforests on one side. We've got deserts on the other. We've got a big mountain range in between. So it's really geographically diverse. People are very diverse from eastern and western Washington. We are from eastern Washington. Actually, pretty much, if you look at a map of Washington, put a pin in the middle of it, it's basically Wenatchee. We are the heart of apple growing country for the entire United States. Our area grows more apples than the rest of the U.S. combined. So huge apple and pear producing region. I like to think it's ripe for cider making, but it's still a growing category in Washington as it is everywhere in the U.S.
If I was to fly into Tacoma, because there's no airport in Seattle, what is it like? Is it an hour outside of Tacoma? Is it an hour from Seattle?
Tacoma, if you land at SeaTac, you're probably about half hour to 45 minutes south of Seattle. From there, if you're going to head eastward, you're going to go right into the mountains within about an hour. You're actually nestled between two mountain ranges when you land in Tacoma. You've got the Olympics on one side and the Cascades on the other. It is.
And those are big mountains. We're talking about 14,000 footers, right?
Oh, yes. Huge mountains, volcanic mountains, actively volcanic mountains. 1980, Mount St. Helens blew. That was huge, huge volcanic blast. Mm-hmm. The effects were seen all around the world. All our major peaks are volcanoes, and a lot of the area is formed by kind of the volcanic activity and a lot of the glaciation that happened through central Washington. Mm-hmm. So it made very unique geography out there.
On May 18th in 1980, at approximately 8:30 a.m. in the morning, Mount St. Helens erupted. A massive debris avalanche triggered by an earthquake that was measured at 5.1 on the Richter scale caused the original eruption that reduced Mount St. Helens' elevation from 9,600 feet to 8,300 feet, nearly 1,300 foot reduction, and replaced it with a 1 mile wide horseshoe shaped crater. In total, 57 people perished during that eruption and the onset of the ash that fell throughout the region. 250 homes were destroyed, 47 bridges, 15 miles of railways, and 185 miles of highway were destroyed. Wheat crops, potatoes, and alfalfa, and apple trees were lost. Interestingly, though, however, in areas blanketed by only a thin covering of ash, the crops survived. And in 1980, the apple yield was higher than normal due to greater than average summer precipitation, which goes to show you that even a volcano can't keep cider out of our glass.
So I get my little rental car and I'm headed out to your place. Is there is it a cider destination out there? Are there a lot of cideries in your area?
Well, no. There's a couple things you need to know. If you're leaving from SeaTac, you have to understand this isn't like being in Massachusetts where you've got about 100 different highways that can take you from point A to point B. Going east and west across the state, you've got basically three main options. Most people would probably opt to take just the main route that goes across the center of Washington through the mountains. If you're coming from Seattle, you'll come through kind of through the north of Yakima first, where there's a couple of cideries. But in central Washington, there's really only a handful, which is surprising for how many orchards there are. The knowledge of apple growing is very strong there. However, in the last probably 2 years, I've seen so many small cideries start up. In our, 20 miles from us, there's probably in the last year alone, 8 to 10 cideries that have just started. I mean, and by just started, I mean they're barely even selling out of their own tasting rooms yet. So there's definitely a growing cider culture, growing awareness. But I think, we started distributing in Seattle because we had a hard time getting traction in Wenatchee. The whole concept of a local farm-to-table cider wasn't attractive to people who spent all day in orchards. Now it is, because they're starting to understand it's very unique and different from what they expected.
Is there a tasting room at your site?
We call it a working tasting room. We actually have two production facilities. What we use as our tasting room is very, we'll call it functional. It's a good place where you can actually drink the cider, but you wouldn't really want to sit in there. It's just kind of a box. But it's beautiful outside, so we try and get it opened up. From our facilities, we have views of Mission Ridge, which is a ski area up in the mountains. We see down along the Columbia River Valley up to the cliffs behind us, so it's a very dramatic scenery. And we do tastings Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 5, throughout the year, and love getting people by. We tend to get more people from around the world than we do from around Wenatchee.
Again, I want to ask you about that. So you're getting people from around the world coming out to your site because
yes.
They heard about Snowdrift Cider. And they're cider tourists, which I love hearing that, and they're willing to kind of drive out into this kind of new epicenter, but, it's kind of an oxymoron a little bit because it's been an epicenter for, growing apples for a long time. What countries are folks coming from?
We get people from all over the U.S. We've had people from in Canada, Chile, Italy, people from the UK. A lot of times when people are coming internationally, they're doing it as part of, it's like the destination they want to have on a business trip. A lot of people that will come out just to see us several states over. That's the sole reason of their visit. We've had people from all parts of Canada as well. We have had people from Mexico in the Oaxacan area. There's a lot of actually old farmsteads where they have actual cider apple varieties. And nobody knows about this, right? Because it's in the middle of Mexico, and not an area you would think of for growing apples, but this little pocket is really good for it.
Nice.
Very tannic, yeah. So we've had people from there come up and visit and want to learn about cider and our ciders.
Your cidery, let's go into that. And I want to give Ciderville a little bit of background where we are. Right now, Tim and I, we're sitting, it's a June day in Brooklyn, New York. So he's traveled all the way from Washington State out to New York City. We're at this event called Pour the Core. And I keep on going back to this guy's booth, and he's standing there, and there's a line going across the whole...
It's crazy.
It's pretty wide.
I felt so bad at the end when they gave me a hard shut off because I had people who had been waiting for 20 minutes and I had to tell them, I can't pour for you.
Oh, that's hard.
But the reception's been incredible out here at this event. I mean, it's been interesting. We've been in New York as a market for a very brief amount of time, but it's a totally different market than Washington. I mean, it's very saturated with everything you can imagine from around the world. Including cider, but a lot of the buyers just are fatigued because they're just bombarded all the time. So this is really refreshing to see all these people so interested in cider, not just cider, but what we're doing and what's different about our process.
And Tim did a presentation today, so he's been talking a bit here, so we're going to just kind of nurture that. And, you know, we know that cider's really good for kind of helping, you know, keep the vocal cords rolling there.
Open.
So let's talk about your cider, and first start with yourself. How did you get into cider making?
Kicking and screaming. So it was actually, a lot of people don't know this about agriculture, but it really is mostly big business now. You can either be managing hundreds or thousands of acres, or you're probably losing money. And the small family farm doesn't really exist like it used to in the U.S., which is what we have. We have a 60-acre farm, and it's my father-in-law's farm, and he's farmed it for, I mean, his family's been farming in central Washington for generations. And so it was something we wanted to keep in the family and do something with, but really to pass it off to the next generation right now is like handing a stack of IOUs. And nobody wants to do that to their children. So the cidery was born out of Peter, he's my father-in-law, it was his vision. And at the time, I didn't even really want to be a part of it. This was early 2000s. I had no idea what cider was. Even Peter at the time didn't really know what cider apple varieties were. We just thought, you know, we want to do something unique and different with the land and make a product here, not just grow apples that we don't even like to eat. We want to do something interesting that intrigues us and can bring more value to the land than just trying to sell to the grocery store chain. It wasn't long after that that we got really lucky. There was a winery that was getting ready to pull out cider apples they had put in. We got access to them, started learning and using them, and realized, oh my gosh, there's a world of difference when you use these traditional varieties. And that was really a big aha moment, a big defining moment for us. And Peter went in and grafted about 2 to 3 acres at the time. Well, it was slowly over a couple of years.
What year did that start? So you're saying like 2000. So
I think the first plantings were like 2005, 2006. We were doing research.
About 10 years ago?
Yeah. It might have been 2004. I'm a little fuzzy on the dates now. But, you know, we were one of the first cider apple orchards in Washington. There was a couple. WSU, Mount Vernon, was already doing some research with them. There was a couple other people who put them in around the same time we did. But we knew from that day that we tried cider apples, that was the only cider we wanted to make. We now have a red-fleshed apple cider, which was kind of was an interesting step for us because it's a very different flavor profile, but at the end of the day, it's a cider apple. It's just not a traditional cider apple. I mean, the flavor characteristics you get off of it are just incredible and completely in a different range of flavors than the traditional, you know, bittersweet, bitter sharp varieties.
So the red flesh, is that called the red flesh cider?
We just call it red. We actually got a cease and desist a while back. We were calling it Nebula Red, and some winery in Colorado just didn't like it. I guess they had a wine called Nebula. So there's been a lot of articles on this actually in the craft beer world. They're running out of names, so you're seeing things like Hot Fuzz and all this weird name stuff. We're like, you know what? No one can tell us we can't use red. It's a color. It's a color, and it's straight and to the point. And really, if you look at our naming lineup. Dry, semi-dry, red. I mean, we haven't been the most creative with our naming.
Well, Snowdrift is a nice name.
Yes.
And then just need that on the label, and then you go from there.
And most people associate with the color anyway, because our labels have a nice kind of, they're each a distinct color.
Right.
So, yeah, the red is, it's made with those red-fleshed apple varieties. And very, very unique. It was exciting the first time getting to actually ferment and play with them.
So let's back up here now. The cider making, kicking and screaming, and you kind of went for it. And then how did you learn how to make these ciders?
If you fast forward a few years, I was only casually involved. I mean, I've always been part of the business, but you know, I was, my wife and I would come and help my father-in-law. It was kind of a one-man show, just a couple hundred cases a year, very early on. But we were living in Seattle at the time, and we decided, you know what, this is not what we want to raise kids. This is not what we want to do long-term. So we quit our jobs, sold our home, and went on a bike tour through Europe for 6 months, which we love bike touring. It's part of what we do. And ended up in Bath, of all places, and invited Peter and my mother-in-law, Marianne, to come visit with us. And we visited a bunch of cideries. And then after they left...
And we're talking about the UK here.
The UK, yes. Yep. Yeah, thank you. So we were visiting all those, like, three county cideries, those West Country cideries. This is back in 2010. And that was very formative for me to see their approach, to see what they were making, how they were doing it. And then I got a chance to take Peter Mitchell's class at his orchard center, which was really great. It's a, you know, Peter has a fantastic approach. It's very analytical, and that really helps me identify problems before they're an issue, which I think is fantastic. And I think everyone can benefit from that in their process. I've tasted a lot of ciders that could have really benefited from that early on. But
I should take a Peter Mitchell course.
Yeah. I think there is this nice dynamic between the art and the science in cider making. And so I kind of feel like I sit between Tom Oliver and Peter Mitchell when it comes to cider making philosophy. You know, Tom just kind of puts the juice in the barrels, let it do what it does, and when it's ready, it's ready.
He took a course from Peter Mitchell.
Yes, I know. And so those were very instrumental. And after we came back, we moved back to Wenatchee, and I started taking over more and more in the production process and cider making process. And now Peter is exclusively on the orchard side, and he's actually the guy you'll interact with if you come out to the tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
And I do all the cider making and events and things like that, obviously, mm-hmm. that I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm. So you make both cider and a perry.
Yes, two perries, actually.
Two perries.
So we are very, very fortunate. We have some local grower who's has branches. We're not even talking full trees of traditional perry pears. We've since added them to our orchard, but everyone in the cider industry knows the pears for your heirs concept. They're tiny.
Well,
they're...
let's slow back, because a lot of people in Ciderville don't know that concept.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, that. What does that mean? Can't you just have a good pear tree? Do all pear trees make the perry that you want?
No, definitely not.
Indeed, there are many different kinds of pears and many different kinds of apples. Tim and I will be chatting more about bittersweet, bitter sharp, and components on cider making that will be quite informative. If you're enjoying Cider Chat and our different discussions with so many cider makers around the world, please tell at least three of your cider-loving fans. And if they're not cider-loving fans, well, grab a glass and have some with them and turn them on to this amazing libation. Do that today and help move the cider agenda to keep going on up. Now, let's get back with Tim Larson of Snowdrift Cider from Washington State.
Just like with cider apples, there are traditional perry pears. Although I would say the biggest difference between apples and pears is that pears have not gone through the extensive breeding programs that apples have. So you can still find commercial pear varieties that are pretty much unchanged from the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
The Seckel pear that we use for our perry that I have here today.
And that's a very tiny pear.
Yeah, it's
pear.
a very tiny pear. When you get it at peak maturity, they're called a sugar pear, by the way, because they're so mm-hmm. sweet. But when you get them at peak tree ripened maturity, you can, I mean, they're lightly astringent. They're full of like spicy polyphenolics, and you get almost like a cinnamon character. Fantastic pears. You ferment through that sugar, and there's actually a lot of sorbitol in these, which is an unfermentable sugar, and you get down to something that's rich and smooth and naturally just lightly sweet and has a lot of rich complexity. It's, I would say, richer and more intense than a lot of like traditional English perries are, but it's, in my understanding, it's indigenous to central Washington. It's just a fantastic pear for making perry from.
Mm-hmm.
However, I have huge respect for the traditional English perry pears. I mean, I love pears. And back to the pears for your heirs comment,
mm-hmm.
you know, pear apple trees, you're talking 4 or 5 years after you plant the tree before you get a harvest, mm-hmm. at least a real harvest. Pear trees, you're talking 10 to 15 years, which is why they say pears for your heirs. And that's, you know, that's regular eating pear varieties, mm-hmm. like 10 years, 8 to 10 years. Peri pears are longer. I mean, ours are like 3 years old, and they still look like a stick in the ground. Mm. We get a few pears off of them, but I think that does more harm to the tree than good, because it does not putting vigor back into the tree. And but those varieties, I mean, I remember we were at, oh, is it Castle Urquhart on Loch Ness? Mm-hmm. They have this big display about how they used to take pears and thought that you couldn't eat them, that they're poisonous unless they were fermented or cooked. And at the time, I thought, that is absurd. And then I had a peri pear. and you have a peri pear and you realize, yeah, of course, nobody's going to eat this and think it's good for you. But the most amazing thing about peri pears is you can, like, every week taste it through its maturation process, and it is a different animal the whole time. It's always evolving. It's beautiful. So difficult to make, though. And I give full props to Pete Brown for his quote about peri. You know, it's, why would anyone drink this wretchedly unfriendly drink? Because when it's done right, it's like drinking angel tears. It's just beautiful. But it can be so terrible, too, when it's not mm-hmm. done right. Mm-hmm. And I've had plenty of terrible peri that I've had to dump out. Mm. It's just part of the game when you make peri.
Yeah. So you have the two peris that you're making. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so we just call it peri or seckle peri. That's a single varietal made with seckle pears. It's a little higher alcohol.
What's the ABV?
8.5% naturally. It'll range from 8 to 8.5, depending on the year.
So you're going to be right in that with the cider act then, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, wow.
And it's available all year. We do a limited release peri that's with these. Just we can do about 80 cases a year, which is about how much we can make with the traditional English peri pears. So we're using like gin, butt, thorn, Winnell's Longden, red pear, and a couple of others. And
how many pear trees is that then in your orchard?
We have a row, so that ends up being like, I don't know, 100 trees or
100
so.
Trees, wow.
And then most of our production actually comes from just these branches that we can harvest from. But excuse me, that goes through a full year, at least a full year after fermentation of aging in usually stainless. And then it goes through the full champagne process, kind of as our salute to the history of the champagne influence on peri making in England and how it kind of has its roots there. And I really think the most elegant thing we make is our reserve peri. It just, the yeast esters and that slightly higher natural carbonation really turn out a beautifully nuanced peri. It's not intense by any stretch of the imagination, but with most peris, it's hard to describe, and it's kind of elusive and evasive, and it's kind of different every time you go back to the glass. And it's very much a traditional English peri from those peri pear varieties.
Is the process the same for making peri as it is for cider? Is there any little tricks of the trade that you
No, it's not to, the same.
Not the same?
I mean, you know, the basic gist of it's the same, right?
It's a very thick, a much
yes,
thicker juice
yeah.
than... So, apple juice that's just compressed.
So the difference starts right with the fruit. You've got very, very little time that you can store pears before they go bad on you. So you've got to deal with them right away. It's typically good to macerate. So crush the fruit.
And say what maceration is.
So it's when you crush the fruit, but you don't press it right away, and it allows the tannins to soften because they are very aggressive. I don't always do that. A lot of times I can get away with not doing that and doing a longer aging time afterwards, but it does definitely shorten your aging time and result in a different peri.
Right.
You also have a lot of compounds in peri that are so different from cider. You've got citric acid and sorbitol are probably the two biggest ones, and a lot of people don't know this, but citric acid anaerobically, which means without oxygen, during fermentation can convert to acetic acid, which is vinegar. So you get a lot of these vinegary peris. That's a huge fault, and it's because the fermentation was not managed appropriately. But it's very hard to avoid that. So it's not like, oh my gosh, how did you make a vinegary peri? No, it's like, oh my gosh, you didn't make a vinegary peri. That's amazing. But then the sorbitol, too, comes with all of its own challenges.
How are you managing that then? You know, you have your pear juice, and is it that time frame right there that you have to really get the yeast going?
Or? Yeah, although, so you have to understand, my cider making philosophy is I don't make cider, I steward yeast. Yeast makes cider. And so long as I make my yeast happy, they're going to do the job that I need them to do, right? It's the same with a dairy farmer.
Yes.
The dairy farmer doesn't make milk. He manages the cows that make the milk.
Right.
It's just a different way to manage and cultivate a good environment for the yeast in peri. Yeah, you do need to inoculate it right away unless you're going to do a wild fermentation, which does work actually pretty well with peri, better, I think, than cider. But it can also, you know, give you really terrible results too. So
right.
Be careful with that.
Right.
For me, peri in particular is very much just an on-the-fly sensory analysis process. I do a lot of testing for volatile acidity, of course, because I want to know before it hits the threshold that it's very obviously becoming vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know that something's going on so I can try and adjust kind of the environment of the yeast that they're working in, maybe
mm-hmm.
change the temperatures or things like that to help them succeed. Maybe there's another organism in there that's out competing with them, and I can help give the right nutrients to give
mm-hmm.
the yeast the boost they need. All sorts
mm-hmm.
of little tricks of the trade, right?
Mm-hmm. We love hearing those.
So there's lots of things that are similar along that fermentation process, but you're looking for different problems and you're addressing them differently. And the sensory analysis part of tasting through the fermentation and testing through the fermentation, you're on the lookout for different things, you're tasting for different things, smelling for different things. I was taking a hydrometer reading in the cidery and a new employee, and I put it up to my ear, and she's like, "What on earth are you doing?" And I said, "I'm listening for bacteria because this is completely still, and I'm listening to see if there's any gas coming off of this." And she's like, You're joking. That's absurd. You're not really doing it. I said, no. Sensory analysis is all of your senses. You use everything, taste, touch, smell, hearing, everything, sight, when you make cider and peri. You can't disengage one or the other. If you do, you're going to miss out on the subtle cues that it's giving you.
Yeah. Well, cool. That's really cool stuff, because I don't think that I've gotten to talk to too many people about peri on this on Cider Chat yet, and so I really appreciate you kind of giving us those little subtleties. So you have the two peris, you have the red.
Yeah.
What else do you have out there? And these are all in 750 ml bottles?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of people ask us for smaller bottles. I don't really see it in our future, because when you make cider from apples you're growing fresh off the farm, it's very expensive to do, and it would be almost as expensive in a small 12-ounce beer bottle, which legally we can't do, as it is in a 750-milliliter bottle. The cost of our products is what's inside the bottle, not the bottle itself. But we have three products that are available all year round. Our Cornus, which is a barrel-aged cider, made primarily with English and French bittersweet cider apples. Year to year, that changes what the exact blend is. But it always has, we use used oak, American oak barrels, because honestly, my feeling is if you use a new barrel with cider, it's going to just end up tasting like drinking out of a stick, you know, a liquefied stick. So a used barrel provides that dynamic aging environment that's really critical for that type of cider.
So when you say a used barrel, these are coming from a distillery?
Yeah, most of them come from a local distillery mm-hmm. In Washington, Dry Fly Distilling,
okay,
out of Spokane. So we use those primarily, and it just results in, I think, a qualitatively better cider. I was kind of on the fence about using barrels, but I'm like, come on, everyone in England and France, that's all they use. And the funny thing is, I used to, at competitions, put our Cornus in with barrel-aged ciders, and it get judged very poorly. Well, this last year at Glint Cap, I put it in under traditional cider, and it took the best in class. And I think it's because a lot of those traditional ciders do have that subtle influence from aging on oak that's so critical for balance and softening acidities and just marrying all the flavors together. So we have our cornice, we have our red, which is also available all year round, made with the red fleshed apples. So it's loaded with anthocyanins. I believe the technical type of anthocyanin is cyanidine.
What does that mean, anthocyanin?
So in food, all foods, you've got polyphenolics are basically the compounds that give you flavor, right? Now, if you think some polyphenolics are tannins, and those are considered procyanidins, those are those bitter, harsh flavors. You might get that in a really big red, something that's bitter or astringent. A lot of times that can be more astringent. You've got a whole host of other types of polyphenolics, and anthocyanins are polyphenolic, and they give you red color. They also give you blue color and all sorts of different colors at different pHs. I discovered this one day as I was using caustic to clean my tank, and everything turned green. I thought, what is going on? So I did some research. This is when I was very early days working with these apples. And discovered, it's anthocyanins, and very specifically, I believe it's cyanidine, which has just a little different red hue than like red wine grapes, which tend to be a little bit more purplish. But it can range all over in color depending on your level of acidity. And these apple varieties give really bright berry notes. Like some of my varieties, after fermentation, it tastes like you're eating near the rind of a watermelon. Some of them taste like an unripe strawberry. And what I realized is a lot of the compounds that are in these apple varieties are also present in those other fruits. I wasn't just seeing red and tasting red. Like it really is, they are related in a lot of ways. There's a ketone, which is kind of like a polyphenolic called raspberry ketone, and that's the raspberryness in raspberries. So if you have that in another food, it's going to pick up those raspberry-like notes. We also do our Seckel Perry that I talked about and our Reserve Perry. Along with our Reserve Perry, we do a Cider Maker's Reserve. Those are in our kind of limited release products. Cider Maker's Reserve is the best of that year's harvest. It goes through a full year of aging, and then when it's ready, it goes through a full year with the champagne process, so in-bottle fermentation, riddling, and disgorging by hand, just like the Reserve Perry. It's by far and away my favorite cider that we make, but we have so little of it, it's always gone before I even get a bottle.
I hope you got to taste it along the way.
Yeah, I taste it all along the way, so I can't complain too much. But it's very rare that I actually get a bottle and can open up a bottle and drink it. We have seasonal ciders. People who have been familiar with our brand for a long time will know we have our Cliff Breaks, which is now our fall seasonal. It's a blend of bittersweets and bitter sharps, so you get kind of this nice range of acidity and tannin. It's a little just off dry, a little sweeter, very appropriate for the fall season.
Just for the folks out in Ciderville hanging out with us on this chat, bittersweet, bitter sharp.
Oh, yes.
These are cider terms and two different kinds of apples. What's the difference between bittersweet and bitter sharp?
Yeah, so those come out of a way to classify apples. Was it Long Ashton? I believe it was Long Ashton. They created this grid. So you either have a sweet apple or a sour apple or a sharp apple. So sharp just refers to the amount of acidity. Mm-hmm. Or you can have a bittersweet or a bitter sharp apple. And basically what that means is a sweet apple has sugar. That's about it. So that's going to be all your apples you get at the grocery store. That's going to be your Red Delicious, your Macintosh, your old school now, but Wine Saps, and all those varieties you get from the grocery store chain. Just a sweet. Cider makers use them from time to time. They can have nice aromatics and stuff. A sharp apple is going to be like your Granny Smith, or if you're in England, it's a culinary apple. They grow like the size of a softball in our orchard, which is very rare.
You actually grow them too.
Yeah, we do grow them. I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on this.
Softball.
They're actually usually small and green in England and used for cooking pies primarily, but same as like a Granny Smith, just tart Bramley.
Bramley?
Yes. And then your bittersweets are going to be like Yarlington Mill and Dobbinette and a whole host of others. I mean, you can find a lot of wild apple varieties that you categorize as a bittersweet. And these are high in tannin and low in acidity. They also have a lot of sugar. That's why they're bitter sweet. And so these are, I would say, my favorite category of apple for cider making, but they're almost impossible to use without their counterpart, the bitter sharps. And the bitter sharps are typically not as tannic, but they do have some good tannin, so that's the bitter part. And they also have a lot of acidity. So they usually are very good for blending in with your bittersweets to get a nice pH or acidity for fermentation, so you have a good, clean fermentation. And can add some nice brightness and more like lemony citrus notes to a cider too. So our Cliff Breaks is a blend of those, almost a 50-50 blend of bittersweet and bitter sharp. So you get this nice range of complex flavors that ranges all over your palate. You know, just a bittersweet cider doesn't hit everywhere on your palate the same way that does. And then we do our semi-dry in the winter, which is our attempt at a New England-style cider. So usually it has some crab apples, it's a little higher alcohol, it's very rich, almost boozy at some points, kind of has the heat of alcohol. But we don't do anything special to it, we just use primarily crab apples in that one. Our Orchard Select is our spring seasonal. It's a bitter sharp focus, so we use a lot of Porter's Perfection and Kingston Black in it. The tannin profile is pretty subdued, but it tends to get more nice bright acidity, so kind of the citrus spectrum, primarily towards grapefruit and then kind of summer fruit. So you get kind of some nectarine and peach hints that come through from it. And then dry, which is our current seasonal, is just a traditional English style dry. I love it. It's probably too austere for most people's palate, but this year it is just basically Yarlington Mill and Dobbinette. So if anyone is interested in tasting really what Yarlington Mill and Dobbinette offer in a cider, this is a bone dry English style.
Perfect to try. Yeah, wow, cider. Wow, wow.
It just made its way to New York, probably landed here earlier this week. So
Snowdrift Cider's available in New York. Of course, it's in the Pacific Northwest, available in Washington State, Oregon, California.
Yeah, so we have really good distribution in the Pacific Northwest, so Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Not so much Idaho yet, but we're getting there. We're also available across California, and we have a map on our website that you can see all the locations that have bought our products and carried them. And then in the Northeast, we're available in New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, and we will be in Connecticut very soon, and very, very little bit in Delaware. But the New England market is very new to us. Oh, and a little props to Ancho Cider in D.C. They carry us, especially on their menu. They're the only place in D.C. that you can get us. But we're very new on the East Coast. It's very new to us. It's a totally different ballgame than cider on the West Coast. So many ways, some good, some bad, some just they are what they are.
Right.
It's been interesting working out here.
Well, so psyched to be able to have you out on this side of the country, no doubt. I have a little query here. When you say or write down cider maker, is it one word or two words for Tim?
One.
One word, okay.
Yes.
And
but my autocorrect always wants me to do it the other way.
What about in your fridge or when you're out and about, if you're not drinking a Snowdrift, what cider do you normally go towards?
Well, I usually can't get them in the U.S., unfortunately. There's a few. I love Eric Bordelais and some of the French-style ciders. I'm not always in the mood for that flavor spectrum, but when I am, there's obviously just nothing else for it. There's a lot of English producers that are hard to find here, and it'd be too long to list, but whether they know it or not, they taught me how to make cider, and that's what I want to emulate. That's why we really value the awards and competitions we get in the UK, because that's what we're trying to emulate, is that process. And there are a couple producers, like I really enjoy Kevin Zielinski's ciders, his, you know, traditional French-style ciders.
Yes, yes.
From Easy Orchards.
Yes.
And Alpenfire has some fantastic from the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. They have some really fantastic tannic ciders that are delicious and great to just get into and geek out about as you drink them and what's going on in them, because they're organic too, so that adds a whole different element to kind of the life cycle of the cider, because it's not as stable in the bottle and it's always evolving and different process than we use. I love and appreciate what they do.
Great. Well, I want to really thank you for spending time with us in this part of Ciderville and sharing your background and the story of Snowdrift. It's really exciting, and we're going to encourage folks to, when they're out in Tacoma, to get in that little car and head out your way.
Yeah, please come visit us. We're off the beaten path. I think in Dumb and Dumber, the movie, if you watch, there's a part where they say, we're going out to the middle of nowhere, and it says to Wenatchee, like 20 miles. So we really are out in the middle of nowhere, but it's worth the visit. It's a very beautiful country, and we'd love to have people out and come out and visit us.
Well, what fun was that, Ciderville, hanging out with Tim, getting a little overview of Washington State and that particular area in the middle of the state. Now you know where Wenatchee exists, and that is such a huge producer of apples. Really informative chat. I also have a little bit of an update on the ciderchat.com website. You can now leave me an actual voicemail. So if you go to the site, up will pop this little speak pipe thing, and you could practice as many times as you want. I don't put anything up that makes people sound like doofuses. I'm just not into that. So you got to trust me, Ciderville, and I think you do. But if you want to say something, and if it works and you want to have that go online, we will do that and get your voice out there too. Even if it's a, hey, Rhea, I really dig the podcast, or how you like to explain a cider to others. No need to be shy. It's really easy to use. You record yourself and you can listen back to make sure that you want to press send. I think it'd be lots of fun. So it's a little speak pipe thing. It just pops up at ciderchat.com. And again, that's where you can see the show notes to this chat with Tim Larson, episode number 37. I also want to encourage you to head over to the Cider Chat Facebook page. There's some really nice folks joining up. I want to read their names kind of quick here. If I've already read your names before, hello again. Here we go. Thank you to Matt, Jamie, Seth, Doris, another Matt, Peter, Rick. Hey, Rick, I know where you are. You're from out in Paonia. Justin, Jessica, Tegan, Lori, Don, Eric, Jeff, Phil, and Chris. I haven't been able to read some of those names in a while, and a lot of folks are coming on board and just, checking out what's getting posted there. I post the weekly episodes and other international news and national news about cider in general. Just some fun things as a nice place to hang out. There's just so much going on Facebook, certainly at Cider Chat on Twitter. Great conversations with everybody this past week. Thank you for spending the little bit of time that I know you have joining me in having a bunch of fun around cider. And it's so much fun. It really is. It's like the party that keeps on going on and going on. I really, really dig it. And a big thank you goes out to David Timmerman this week for his patronage to a Cider Chat. Podcasting, it's really following that same trajectory as cider, in that not everyone has heard about nor realized that cider and this here Cider Chat podcast is even an option. That is a real challenge for the industry. I know it's a challenge for the podcast, so that's why I ask you to share it. But just not having enough options on the shelf, man, that is a drag. You're constantly seeing folks getting really excited about cider that, frankly, I don't even call it cider because it's kind of like juice, not even juice. It starts with water and sugar and maybe apple flavoring. So there's a lot going on there. I'll probably address this more as we go along. I always like to stay in the happy bubble of Ciderville, of course. And part of that happiness is someone like David stepping forward and taking the time to join on my Patreon page, which is in support of this podcast. It's really easy. Just for merely $3 a month, you could help support this podcast in a super duper big way. So check it out. You could see it on the show notes, or just merely Google Cider Chat Patreon. That's Patreon. Great stuff happening there. And I always like to thank the commercial cider makers that help this chat to continue to go out and speak to cider makers around the world, not necessarily their own. And that is a special thank you to Joe Getz at Current Cider for being awesome, doing the great work that you do down in Pennsylvania. I know you just had the Cider Week, and helping support this podcast. Thanks a lot, buddy. Okie dokie. Well, I think I am ready to roll out of here. So I'm going to head out for now, Ciderville. I hope you have a good ciders to choose from that you're looking forward to try. And I'll catch you on the flip side of this podcast. This is Real Wind Color signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville. Going up.